Hello and welcome to Curious Emotion. I'm Sam McCormick and this is the final episode of Series 1. I know this year has been very challenging and here in the UK we've just had more last minute changes to the COVID restrictions. So I'm really grateful that we're finishing this series with a person who brings such love, care and joy to everything he does, Nunu Silva. Nunu is a dancer and performer who is currently the Associate Movement Director on Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. He gives us a glimpse into the backstage world of the play, and despite the incredible challenges everyone in the team is continuing to face this year, how he has found joy and hope. Nunu is originally from Portugal, and I met him a few years ago when he was touring his own work, A Darker Shade of Fado, where my husband Matt was one of the performers. So we begin our episode by finding out about the story of Nunu's earlier life and how that led to becoming an original cast member on Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Right, welcome Nunu. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Sam.
It's a real privilege to get to chat to you and I wish we were together, but this is better than nothing.
It is indeed, yes.
So I wanted to start by talking about your work and where you grew up and the influences on that. So I was wondering how your Portuguese heritage influences your work.
Of course, yeah. So I was born in Portugal many, many moons ago, too many to count and to tell. And I was born in Lisbon, in the glorious sunny city of Lisbon. So I grew up there, normal kid, going to high school and school. I was always very active. Me and my brother, we were very lucky, me and my brother, that my parents would give us lots of stimuli. So swimming, karate, gymnastics, theatre groups, choir, music, piano, the recording, you know, lots of things for us to do to learn, like sponges. And then after high school, I went to drama college in Lisbon. I did that for 3 years. And throughout those 3 years, my curiosity towards movement, towards dance, began appearing and seeping through. So after I finished those 3 years, I came to London, where I normally am, and currently am indeed. Mm. And I studied a further 3 years in a performing arts school called London Studio Centre, which was at King's Cross, and now it's been relocated to Finchley, to North London. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, like my process and my progress through my late teens and early adulthood. Now, with regards to my Portuguese heritage, I remember coming to London when I was about 19 when I started college here, and I brought a CD. We still used CDs back then.
back in the day,
of this amazing singer called Amália Rodrigues. She's passed away now, but she was the queen of fado. Fado is a Portuguese traditional type of song, and so I brought with me that double CD of her hits. And I would, after college, so I'd get home quite late because I would be there the whole day, like till 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, and then get home, have a bite to eat, go to bed, and just put my Amália songs in my head, and I would just listen to those songs and go to sleep with it. And it's funny because when I was in Portugal, I didn't used to listen to fado. I didn't used to go to fado houses at all because I was brought up in the suburbs of Lisbon. I would go into Lisbon, my late teens, to go to the drama college, but I was never big into the traditional side of Portuguese life. Mm. My parents being very liberal, you know, we would go to concerts, you know, to orchestras, we'd go to museums, we'd go to movies, that sort of thing, rather than going to a fado house. It's not that I considered them very, you know, too traditional, too backward thinking, because they're not. But it was something that I was, you know, I was never too keen on.
Hmm.
But once I left Portugal, it was almost like there was a little happy bug inside my, you know, heart or something. It's kind of like, I'm here, I'm calling you. and it gradually spread, you know, happily through my body, so that once I finished college and I went into contemporary dance companies, and then I went to musicals and theatre productions and all those things, eventually I decided to do my own projects.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the very first things that I did was to use that little happy bug of fado. And I latched onto that idea of fado because by then, having burned the CD completely, I knew some of those songs and they meant a lot to me, being a, you know, an immigrant, a Portuguese person in the UK. I knew them, and they related to my sense of nostalgia, my sense of belonging somewhere, not necessarily back at home, but, you know, a creative place.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's not just where you came from, it's somewhere where you want to be, and that might not be the place that you left. So when I started creating my own work, I used fado, this Portuguese traditional type of song, to create something and to say something, to say stories, to tell stories through fado music and also through contemporary dance and storytelling.
With fado, can you give us just a little bit of background on what fado involves and the traditions around that?
Of course. So fado, it's funny because these days I'm mainly learning about yoga.
Mm.
And yesterday we had a webinar about the roots and the history of yoga, how it came about. And I thought that that was so similar to the roots of fado, because there's lots of people, oh, yoga came from here. And fado is exactly the same thing.
Right.
So people say, oh, fado came from the Arabs. Fado came from the Orient. It came from the slaves and in the ships. It came from the romance songs in the Middle Ages. You know, there's so many strands. And actually, fado seems, these days people seem to agree on, that it crystallized somewhere around the Napoleonic Wars. So beginning of the 19th century, 1820s, 1830s, in Lisbon mainly, and it was sung by prostitutes, by pimps, so the lowlifes, by the river in Lisbon, where streets were dark and there were brothels, and the prostitutes would sing these songs, and they were filthy, filthy songs, because that's how they would get the customers in.
I see.
You know, so it wasn't like, oh, come to this establishment. No, it's like, you filthy so-and-so, come here, and they would come. So that's how fado started.
Wow.
Yeah, so it started very in a very low place. And then eventually it made its way to the palaces, almost like a tourist, you know, a touristic attraction. So they had to clean themselves and their language.
Uh-huh.
And then, so the traditional setup of fado is one singer and two guitarists. One guitar is the classical Spanish guitar, and the other one is a traditional Portuguese guitar, which is shaped like either a pear or a tear, depending on how you want to look at it. And it has five double strings. And that the Portuguese guitar accompanies the melody, so accompanies the singer. And the Spanish classical guitar does the rhythm and does the pace. So that's the classical, traditional kind of format of fado,
mm-hmm.
which these days, you know, fado, you have fado in pop, you have fado in rock and roll and R&B, you know, lots of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what drew you to fado for your work? What did you choose to use it for?
I was just so curious about, firstly, the origins and how it came about, especially because me being in England and fado coming from my, you know, country of birth, and I knew almost nothing of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it came from that original curiosity of what is it actually, you know, because my connection to it was this double CD of Amalia's songs. And, you know, that's a very tenuous relationship, if one can put it that way. So it was about delving a little bit deeper into what it is and then starting to sing it, because I think it was my way of getting close to the idea of what it actually was, rather than just reading about it, to sing, you know, because having spent 3 years at the London Studio Centre also learning how to sing along with the dancing. And before that, I was part of choirs and learning music and stuff, so I had some affinity with song and singing. And then the next obvious step, because I was learning how to move and how to dance, was to merge it, to bring the singing to the dancing, especially also because I found out that fado, which these days is only a song, a type of song, fado used to be danced as well. So like flamenco, flamenco is sung and flamenco is danced, fado used to have a dance to it as well, which gradually it just kind of withered down. And now these days, if you see a traditional fado singer, you know, they have their chests a bit pumped up, and the women use shawls, and they use like certain jerky movements of the shoulders and then of the head. And that is a withered down version of the dance itself. The dance had leg movements. It was almost like a dance-off, if, uh-huh, you know, from, yeah, you know, like R&B and those, the B-boys and B-girls. So it was a call and response, but with the movements, with the hips, with the shoulders, and eventually got whittled down to just one person doing small movements as they're singing. And with the melismas, that which are, is when you're singing, so for instance, Mariah Carey or Whitney Houston, when they're singing a note and then they do like frilly bits, like, ah, yeah, like that. So that's a melisma. Mm-hmm. And those, that physicalization of the voice came from the physicalization of the body. So movements that would give an intonation to the voice. And I found that so interesting. And then I wanted to just explore that. And because I always loved telling stories, I, you know, I would find or create some stories and tell those stories through fado and through dancing.
What an absolutely rich subject. I had no idea about the dance link with fado.
Yeah.
That is absolutely incredible. Fascinating.
Yeah, which also came a little bit from Brazil, because, yeah, during the discoveries in the 1500s, 1600s, there was this kind of interaction from Lisbon to Rio or Portugal to Brazil. Lots of boats going to and fro, merchandise and people, songs, culture, lots of traditions to and fro. And there is actually a type of dance in Brazil, I don't think they dance it now, but they used to, called fado. Yeah, so some Brazilians say, oh, fado came from Brazil, which is not true. I mean, not true in the sense that it was something different to what fado is now. So it probably might have been a strand, which is so incredible and rich. It just enriches, obviously. Mm. But it's fascinating. It's fascinating.
You're obviously now working on Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, or, you know, I know it's a very strange time to be talking about this at the moment.
Yeah, oh no, it's fine.
So is fado, is your heritage, your exploration into that work still ongoing, even though you have, obviously, most of your time normally would be taken up with the play?
Yeah, so it's now kind of in a shelf. In, yeah, my heart has many shelves, and yeah, one of those shelves is... fado is now temporarily in there. Yeah, it's mainly due to time constraints.
Yeah, of course, really.
When I presented A Dark Shade of Fado, which was a show that I made, and Matt Lackford,
yes,
was
my lovely
one
husband.
Of the dancers. Yeah, lovely husband. He was one of the amazing dancers, and he played and he sang. You know, we all did everything. That kind of finished in 2016, which was exactly when I started Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. And actually, there was an overlap period where we did this final show at King's College on the Strand in Aldwych, and that was, I think, the 1st of April. And we had started rehearsals for Harry Potter Cursed Child in February. So I was already rehearsing for Harry Potter, and then having to create or adapt this piece, because it was like a not a best of, but it was a Darker Shade of Fado, which was the indoor show. And then we also did snippets of Soul of Fado, which was the outdoor show that we took around to the outdoor festivals in the UK. And then we had a premiere of a new piece. We had a trio come from Portugal to play, and I was singing with them. So it was, but this being the King's College, they didn't have a theatre. They had like an auditorium that was a multi-use kind of space, but we had to bring in the sound, we had to bring in the floor, everything. So I was already rehearsing with Harry Potter. It was insane, you know. It was
Wow.
incredible, but it was insane.
Yeah, that's major.
Yeah, it was major. It felt like a marathon. So then when that finished and I continued with Harry Potter, I was on stage playing the role of Bane. And I was also movement captain, so throughout that first year. And then I was doing the second, so I've been there since 2016, so coming up to 5 years now. So during my first 2 years, I was on stage. First year, I was also movement captain. And the second year, I was made resident movement director, so I was looking after the audition process for the movement side, rehearsing the understudies and the main cast, everything. And then the third and fourth year, I left the stage side just to focus on the resident movement director side of it. And they would send me out to other productions that started opening up. So I went to Broadway to help set that up there. I did a round of auditions in Los Angeles, Toronto, Chicago. And then last year, they sent me over to Hamburg for the opening of the Harry Potter und das verwunschene Kind, which is the very first non-English speaking production of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. So I got to stay there for 5 months, which is incredible. I loved it. And the cast and the team, the production team, the stage manager, you know, everybody was incredible. I loved it. And then just one day, the day before the press night, that's when Germany said, okay, COVID is too much. We are going
Oh.
to. So we postponed one day before press night, and it's still in, yeah, it's still being postponed,
Yeah.
which is sad. So I actually came back. So that was a Friday, the 13th, Friday 13th, when it got postponed in March, yeah. And I came back to London on the Saturday. Because on the Monday we were going to start rehearsals for the new cast, year five in London. And that was Monday the 16th. So we actually started rehearsals. And then Boris said that social distancing measures had to be implemented and we were told to go home. So we did one half day, maybe half day of work. And then we were sent home. And ever since.
Yeah,
So.
ever since, I know. So, how often does the cast change in the London show?
Yearly.
Yearly. Okay, and it's
Yeah.
around that time then, so you've just got a new
Exactly.
cast, which is a massive process to get to that point, I can imagine, as
Oh
well.
my Dumbledore. Yes, completely. We start auditioning people round about September. Sometimes in August, we have open calls for performers who are younger or haven't gone to college but want to know what this is all about. So we just do open calls for people. And then September, we start auditioning everybody. And then sometimes it goes well into December with those auditions so that we start rehearsals in March. And then rehearsals are about 2.5 months until the premiere of the new cast around the end of May. And then after the premiere, we still have a good 2 months kind of to rehearse the understudies. And then everything is open and people can take holidays. And and the show is safe. It's in safe hands because we've taught not just the main cast. I mean, they're all the main cast, but the main cast, the swings and the covers, the understudies.
Yeah. Can you just explain what a swing and a cover is for those of us not in that world?
Of course, yes. So it's funny because sometimes people think also that the principals are more important and then there's the understudies and then the swing. And it's not like that at all. If anything, for the well-being of the show, it's actually the other way around. So the swings, a swing is a performer whose job it is to learn several tracks in the show so that if there's an illness or an injury, the swing, that performer can jump straight into the show and they will know what to do, where to change their lines, songs, if there are songs in our show, there's no songs, the props, where to get them, you know, and the show runs smoothly.
Yeah.
So a swing will learn several different tracks. And then we have the understudies, which it's almost like a swing, but the understudies, their role is to study or understudy just a few main roles. So, for instance, you have the Harry Potter role or the Hermione role or the Ron role, and you've got understudy number one, understudy number two, and sometimes understudy number three. And again, it's their job to, if the performer who's being Harry Potter is either ill or injured or on holiday, they will step up and they will, you know, they've been briefed, they'll be rehearsed throughout the whole period, and the show can go on smoothly so the audience can still enjoy the whole show. And also us on stage, we feel secure that the understudies and the swings know what they're doing, and we and they can feel we can support each other mutually. Yeah, so those are the roles. So the main cast, the understudies and the swings. Swings can also be understudies. Yeah, it's quite complicated.
Very complicated. And what an absolute talent to be a swing in the sense of, and all of them, but particularly that idea of just jumping in anywhere that it could be.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. Yeah. And I see what you mean about how that's essential, isn't it, for the show to be up and running and safe, as you say.
Completely. And sometimes a swing has to go on mid-show.
Yeah.
Because either somebody, you know, feels sickly or has a halfway, and we need to call this, okay, you're on. And part of my job, my role, is to ensure that a swing or an understudy, anybody who has an active role in the show, knows what they need to do with safety and with confidence so that they can just go and do their best and things run smoothly. And it's a good show for the audience and for everybody backstage.
Amazing. Now, I know that I've seen the show, and I will not say anything about what happens because...
Keep the secrets.
Yes, hashtag keep the secrets. Do not worry, we will not talk about it. But it is incredible. And I look forward to when it's able to be on again.
So do I.
What's your favourite thing about your role working on the play?
So my role has changed over these years, over these 5 years, and I have loved every single minute of it. So whereas before I was on stage and a creative as well as a movement captain and a rehearsal director, I was able to have kind of both worlds. So being able to perform, and, you know, I've always been very physical with my performance, you know, coming from a dance background, acrobatics background. I love to be active. I love to move and I love to be engaged and involved. And so much so that when we were making the show and the choreographer, Stephen Hoggett, with his assistant, Neil Bettles, we would be, you know, making a choreography or a transition. And it was very, communal. So it was very collaborative, that's the word, yes. So Stephen would give us some tasks or give us snippets of movement, and then we would create something and then give it back to him, and he would shape it, you know, so lovely. I love these kind of processes. And I was always like raring and, okay, I'll do it, so much so that, you know, people look at me like, no, calm down. Or the other way around, like if people were tired, like, Nina will do it. And I'm always up for that. I'm always up for, you know, for trying stuff out. And so I love that about when I was on stage and creating it. And then obviously it was also part of my job to make sure that the choreography and the movement, the quality was there once we opened and once we rehearse the understudies and the new casts. It was also down to me and other people to make sure that we would pass on important information, tools, so that everybody got the most out of that experience, so that they could do the best job that they could, you know, to the audience. Once I left the stage and I became just the resident movement director, which was something that I couldn't do so much in terms of show watching. So one of the most important things that a rehearsal movement director has to do is to show watch, to see if there's anything that needs adjusting or rehearsing, or give praise, obviously, you know, they're amazing performers. And one of the most enjoyable things for me was being in the audience and then hearing the gasps of people go, oh, that was incredible. And then just, you know, they would turn around to complete strangers sometimes, you know, because they didn't know each other. And, oh, that was incredible. How did they do that? You know, that was magical. And then in the breaks and the pauses, I would linger a little bit and just hear the comments of people. And mostly, you know, they were so positive and so in awe of the staging, of the performances, of the music as well. Because even though it's not a musical, the music is absolutely gorgeous, as is the magic and, you know, the costumes and the wigs and everything. Yeah, and when I got to go to Hamburg to set up this time as the associate movement director, you know, I got to take them all, so take the performers and the stage crew. I would lead a warm-up every morning for an hour, and I would invite everybody, you know, creatives, performers, stage crew to be part of it and to lead them through that path. So from day one of rehearsals, and we do very physical things, because Stephen, you know, he's like, a performer's body and mind needs to be strong, you know, it needs to be flexible. We have to have stamina, because these are long days. There's two plays, you know, we do three doubles, so three, a matinee and evening on a Wednesday, a Saturday and Sunday.
Wow,
so
it's your average West End show, isn't it?
Absolutely. The good thing is that we have 2 days off rather than just the one,
right?
Because we have the double on the weekend. You know, the performers need to be fit, need to be healthy. And for me, it was so incredible to lead them or help them through that journey of self-discovery and empowerment from day one of rehearsals till, you know, the day before the premiere.
Yeah.
Which will come around. It's fine. It'll come around.
In terms of now, you know, the continual effect that the pandemic is having on the West End, on theatres, on performers all over the world, how have you and your team dealt with well-being for the cast and for everybody involved?
Yeah, so I'm going to start just for my own kind of perspective. Straight away from that first week, the week of the 16th of March, on the Wednesday, I decided to start teaching some Zoom yoga classes and HIIT classes as well, just to keep people going. Because by then we didn't quite know, you know, when we would come back or not. So I was like, you know what, let's just do this like every other day. So 3 times a week, you know, so maybe on a Monday, it would be half an hour of HIIT or Tabata. So, you know, energetic class, and then straight into a yoga class, so half an hour. And if people didn't have time, you know, people, I would tell people, you can do as much or as little as you want. You don't even need to do this. These classes are just here if you need them, you know. Even if you just want to sit down with a cup of tea and have the screen on and see other people sweating and cursing me at the same time, absolutely fine. It's just a way of keeping that contact and that connection going through those days and those weeks and months. You know, and I opened this for the London and the Hamburg productions. So sometimes we'd have like 50 people join in. Sometimes it'd be 30, sometimes it'd be 20. It's whatever they would want to do. And it was funny because in Hamburg, they would do every other day. So if I would do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, in Hamburg, they would do like Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday. So people, if they wanted to do one day and couldn't make the other, they could, you know, they could swap, they could change around. And I found, for me personally, that kept me going. Because not just from a physical point of view, but from a mental point of view, because I would have to prepare these classes and I would have so much joy preparing them. So for the HIIT workouts, I would sort out the sort of exercises, you know, the press-ups and the squats and the high planks and shoulder taps. I would prepare the playlists as well. So I would really customize the tracks so that they were uplifting and the nice beats. And then for the yoga, I would get nice cool-down music so that people could relax. I would find quotes of that specific day, say if it was, I don't know, the 4th of May, who was born on that day in history, and were they, you know, inspirational people, and what did they say? So I would look up the, you know, quotes for their people that they had said, and if they were inspirational, I would say it throughout the class.
Oh, I love that.
You know, so it just, you know, it was just so, and I keep doing, like, actually this morning, I taught again another class, and it was Tina Turner's birthday. It's her birthday today. And actually, I've got a quote here from her. What did she say? What did she say? Tina said that, "I believe that if you just stand up and go, life will open up for you."
Oh, lovely.
I love that. And that's between Sun Salutation A and Sun Salutation B. Yeah, so, you know, it's that has kept me going.
Yeah.
And I think and I hope that the cast and, you know, everybody who has joined these classes, you know, they take something positive from these classes, because some people have been able to do some things, some others haven't.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of have chosen a little bit not to, it's not that I've chosen not to work, but I'm not actively looking for work. One, I'm on furlough, which is, so, you know, it's a Dumbledore send. And the other reason is because as soon as we knew that we weren't going to reopen like in October, I think this is like June time, they were like, okay, only 2021. I decided to study yoga and study personal training. So I started my yoga teacher's training, the 200 hours, because even though I knew about yoga and I knew how to practice and how to teach yoga, I mean, very basic, it was all empirical. So it was all through my own personal experience with dance companies and warm-ups on stage and stuff. So it was very, you know, very minuscule, my knowledge. So I decided, as soon as we understood that we're going to be closed for a lot longer, I was like, okay, so that will enable me time-wise to actually invest in a course and go and study. So I did that. So I did my 200 hours. On the back of the 200 hours, there was a 300 hours that was going to happen as well, but there was a hiatus of about a month before the course was open. So I decided to study level 2 personal training, which is the entry level of personal training. So I've done that, I finished that. And before I start my level 3 PT, I went back to the yoga because it's right now it's very close to my heart. So I started my 300-hour yoga. And then once I finish that, I will go back and finish my level 3 PT. And this is mainly, obviously, to keep me going, to keep me sane and give me some sense of schedule and goal setting in my life. But also, in the future, you know, if I need to move either back to Portugal or to Spain, or say if I, you know, if the theatres still kind of remain, you know, if it's complicated, I will have the means to go into another job that is close to my heart, and I'll have more knowledge. And the second thing that told me you should do this is also because when I'm teaching the performers in Harry Potter, leading rehearsals, leading auditions, the fact that hopefully by the end of this COVID time, that I would have more knowledge about the body, about yoga, about exercises, and I can impart my knowledge with those performers so I can help them be a better performer, be a better human being, physical, mentally. So yeah, those two main kind of reasons, different job and imparting with more knowledge to others. Those are my sources of inspiration.
I mean, I can only speak from my experience, but I think when you work very closely with performers or any sort of very close process, which the arts, it is quite hard to explain how close you can kind of build a family in a rehearsal process if you've not been in it before. I always find that difficult to put into words, but I can imagine, like you were saying, the journey of leading the whole team, you know, backstage, on stage, through that process in normal times before COVID, and the journey that you're seeing them go on is, it's fundamental to people's lives, isn't it? It's not just a job. It's sort of, it makes them who they are in a way.
Yeah, it's give them trust. And, you know, because without trust in such a small and enclosed environment, it can be quite difficult. So it's to be open and lead, like you were saying, you know, to carry everybody with the same respect and confidence and nurturing and love and support.
Absolutely. And that just becomes more important and more important, doesn't it, when this is taken away all of a sudden, very unexpectedly.
One of the things that I would always do, or that we would always do in rehearsals during the warm-ups, is to allow people to walk around in any direction and then find somebody else, give them a hug, and then release, continue walking, find somebody else, give them another hug, you know, which is so important. And it was important pre-COVID, and now we can't really do it. But once this whole time is kind of done with, I cannot wait to go back into the studio and give people hugs. I love giving people hugs.
Me too. I keep envisaging that. That's what's keeping me going, little like daydreaming of what it'll be like to get that group back together and the big hug everybody's going to get.
Just
amazing.
It will happen.
It will.
I'm so confident.
So what's the plan at the moment? I know that plans are, you know, nothing is set in stone, but we're looking at 2021 for the play to be back in some form.
Yeah, so there is nothing set in stone. I think I saw, I don't know if it was the government or I read on the website, that in a year's time, I think life might come to what it was before, to some normality.
Yeah.
So if that's in a year's time, hopefully a few months before, I don't know, August, September, we might be able to start rehearsals so that we could open, you know. But this is me just, you know, conjecturing, if that's such a word.
Yeah. And there's obviously the rehearsal process to bear in mind, it's not just putting a show back on, is it? There's a huge amount of work before a show can be there. So,
and it's going to be a year, you know, since we were all together. And, you know, people forget not just lines, but movements, technical, because it's a very complex show. So it's gonna take a while. But in the meantime, all we can do is to, you know, keep learning, keep exploring, keep, you know, if you, even if you have to stay at home because you're self-isolating, there's so much you can do. There's yoga, there's lots of exercise, there's apps, there's YouTube that is free, there's lots of books, there's, you know, podcasts like the one that you're doing. You know, there's an incredible array of things to stimulate your mind and your body. So I'm a firm believer of not keeping still, even though you are still inside a house. There's so much to do and so many outlets these days, so many sources to keep your mind and your body engaged. It's, you know, we're so lucky.
We are incredibly lucky to have this option and to be able to connect. And I think when, you know, you're using your creative skills still to think about how can I use this new way of working and how can we still find benefit in this and find something new that maybe we wouldn't get in the studio together. Or
absolutely,
Nunu, thank you so much. I'm sending massive virtual hugs to everyone at the moment.
Yes, me too. Yeah. I receive yours. Yeah, it's here. I'm warm already.
Love it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and let's just keep that in our minds of when everybody's going to be back together and those lovely big hugs when that happens. Yes. And good luck with your yoga as well.
Yes. Yeah, I also teach Harry Potter themed yoga classes.
I love your use of the characters. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to let people find out for themselves, but it's fantastic. I love it.
Thank you, Sam.
So yeah, wishing you all the best and thank you again.
You too. Thank you, Sam.
Oh, thank you, Nunu, for that uplifting, warm and fascinating chat. I wish the whole team at Harry Potter and the Cursed Child and everyone involved in theatre, shows, productions and events all the love for 2021. I know it's hard at the moment, but let's keep thinking of those days when we will be reunited. That goes for you too, our lovely listeners. Creating this podcast has been a real journey of discovery, vulnerability and learning for me, and I'm so grateful to you for coming along for the ride. I hope you found inspiration, comfort and entertainment in this series, and I look forward to bringing you the next one. We'd love to hear your feedback. Do you have a favourite episode or a topic you'd like us to chat about? Get in touch. You can email us on hello@curiousmotion.org.uk or send us a message on social media. A big thank you to the Coronavirus Community Support Fund, distributed by the National Lottery Community Fund, the Adventure Programme and the Community Foundation for Calderdale for supporting the launch of this podcast. We're a very small not-for-profit organisation and your support means the world to us. Finally, I wish you a peaceful, healthy and restful Christmas period, however you are spending it. I know it might feel tough, but remember you are not alone and do reach out for support if you need it. You can find some information on this on our website. We will be back in the new year to keep you company too. Until then, thank you so much for listening. Remember to tune into your body, be kind to yourself, and stay curious. Bye.